on, or acting on functions of either the integers or Z2, and you basically do a fractional integration in the discrete case, which means a fractional summation, and you subtract off either squares or m and m squared. Now, what you're interested in is the LP-LQ boundedness properties of these operators, and you can guess what you'd expect by looking at the continuous analogs. This operator here is just fractional integration after a change of variables. This operator here is a bit more complicated, but it's a result of CRISP that we do know the optimal LP-LQ boundedness properties of this operator. Now, discrete analogs have aroused some interest recently, and a very, very brief history of papers directly related to this setting. Stein and Wenger credit Arkhipov and Oskolkov for the first sort of work in this area looking at a discrete Hilbert transform-like operator. But it was really Bourgain in the late 80s who wrote papers that introduced circle method ideas into the arena, and that really got the field going. And then Stein and Wenger wrote a series of three papers looking at discrete singular radon transforms in the quasi-commutative case, and also on these fractional integral operators here. And D. Oberlin wrote a paper getting some crucial bounds for small lambda for these operators. And finally, Ionescu and Wenger wrote a very deep paper that provided a crucial interpolation estimate for discrete singular radon transforms in the commutative case. So I'll be looking at a generalization of these operators with quadratic forms. So given Q1 and Q2 positive definite quadratic forms with integer coefficients for lambda between 0 and 1, we define the analogous operators just replacing the modulus squared by one of these quadratic forms. And you can have a different quadratic form in the numerator and the denominator. Now, just to give you a bit of intuition, the simplest example would be you pick both the quadratic forms to be the modulus squared, and then you have the simple higher dimensional analogs of the operators that Stein and Wenger considered. Now, the theorems that I'll prove are a bit complicated looking, but can't really avoid that. So for dimension k bigger than or equal to 4, this I lambda operator is a bounded operator from LP to LQ precisely when lambda is bigger than k over 2 minus k. And 1 over q satisfies this relation with 1 over p. And the second condition pops up only in the discrete case. It looks a bit fancier than it really needs to be. It basically says p is bigger than 1, q is less than infinity. But I write it this way for consistency with other literature. Now, in particular, there exists a constant that must depend on the quadratic forms, as far as I can see, such that the LQ norm is bounded by the LP norm times this constant. Now, for lower dimensions, k equals 2 and 3, there are some complications that arise. In particular, these results continue to hold for lambda bigger than a half, but there are two small regions for lambda less than a half that still need to be considered. I have some weaker results. That's work in progress to make them sharp. For the J lambda operator, you get similar results, and these results are sharp for lambda in the region I consider. For lambda less than 2 over k plus 4, there are, again, some non-sharp results that I have. But unfortunately, one runs into very deep number theoretic conjectures and problems when one tries to take lambda much smaller than this. And so that's still work in progress, possibly by me and possibly for many decades for other people. So I'd like to talk a little bit about how you go about proving these theorems, because the method of proof is really where the interest, for me at least, arises. So a bit of notation: for Q, a positive definite quadratic form with integer coefficients, it has a matrix representation. So A is a symmetric positive definite integer matrix. And I'll take it to have even diagonal entries, which for the number theorist means twos in convention. So Q star is the adjoint quadratic form, and it corresponds to the inverse of that matrix. And it's a very trivial observation, but a useful one, that you can compare any two positive definite quadratic forms. So with some up to some constants, they're comparable to each other. In particular, this means at the operator level that we can swap quadratic forms in and out of the denominator of the operators. So it might seem convenient to have what you could call the generic quadratic form of the modulus squared in the denominator, because it's something familiar looking. We know how to deal with it. But in fact, it's quite crucial to have the same quadratic form in the numerator and the denominator when you actually go about proving things. because of symmetry conditions on the theta function that's associated to the quadratic form. So from now on, we'll assume that we have a fixed quadratic form Q that appears above and below, and we'll denote the resulting operators just with one Q in the subscript. That's just a condition. Remember, you divide out by 1/2. So, for example, the modulus squared would correspond to the matrix with 2's on the diagonals, and you divide it by 1/2. Yeah, so that's easy to see when the form is diagonal, for example, and then you just do a change of variables and diagonalize. Remember, we're only plugging in integers, and they have integer coefficients. So it's interesting to see how these conditions in the theorems are necessary as well as sufficient for LPLQ boundedness. So, for example, if you look at condition 2 for the J lambda operator, that just said that 1 over Q has to be less than lambda, and correspondingly, 1 over P must be bigger than 1 minus lambda. So let's see why this is. If you define F of NT to be 1 at the origin and 0 everywhere else, then clearly it's in little LP. You can do a very simple computation and show that the LQ norm of the operator looks like T to the minus K lambda Q over 2 times some function R related to the quadratic form. And this R sub Q function is the number of representations of your integer by Q. That's a simple computation, but just take it on faith if you don't see it. So if we knew that this RQ function behaved like n to the k over 2 minus 1, we'd get exactly what we wanted, very simply. T is a positive integer here. But it's quite a deep question whether this RQ function behaves like this or not. So you can turn to a heavy-duty result of Avanich on the number of representations by a quadratic form in 4 or more variables. So that shows that R sub Q behaves like n to the k over 2 minus 1 with an Archimedean constant, and this thing is called the singular series. Now, the singular series has a fancy definition either as a sum or as a product of local densities, but I write this for completeness, but you can ignore it, because for my purposes, all I need is that it doesn't vanish. Now, you could assume that Q is what's called a universal quadratic form, meaning it represents every positive integer. That's very restrictive. There are, for example, only about 200 four-variable universal quadratic forms. So we don't want to do that. You could look at some complicated congruence conditions for every prime that divides 2 or the determinant of the matrix, also too fancy. For my purposes, I just show that it doesn't vanish for at least a positive density of n, and that's enough. So that's at least a hint of how you prove that the conditions are necessary. Let's talk about how you prove that they're sufficient. And you go about this with a pretty typical Fourier multiplier argument. You want to show that the multiplier of the operator I lambda is in a weak LR space, and then the associated operator is bounded from LP to LQ for 1 over Q equals 1 over P minus 1 over R. So here's the multiplier. And a simple identity, basically reviewing a proof of what the gamma function is, allows you to restrict your attention to a multiplier that's effectively an integral from 0 to 1, broken up diagonally, of a theta function times y to the k lambda over 2 minus 1. And the theta function is quite simple. You simply sum over k tuples of integers, e to the minus 2 pi q of m z. And if you happen to read number theory books for fun, you're used to having e to the positive 2 pi I q of m z, and then you look in the upper half plane. But here it's convenient for me to look in the right half plane, so we look at real part of z bigger than 0. The theta function is quite crucial to the argument. So here it is again. It's a theta function with respect to a fixed quadratic form. And the key property is that it has a Jacobi inversion formula, which relates the theta function for q with the theta function for q star at 1 over z. And this is, roughly speaking, there are constants, and there's a z to the minus k over 2 on the right-hand side as well. So remember, q star is the adjoint quadratic form. Now, in my particular case, this works out to be the following transformation law. For real part of z greater than 0, if you look at your k tuple of integers m as a fixed residue class modulo q, where q is a fixed modulus, then you get your theta function on the left-hand side and the theta function of 1 over z on the right-hand side. And you have your z to the minus k out front. And what's interesting here is that you see some arithmetic information popping up here in the e to the 2 pi I r dot l, where r and l are k tuples of integers. So in order to take advantage of this arithmetic information, we need to use the circle method. So for the third time today, you will see the Dirichlet approximation formula, or a Faraday dissection of level 2 to the j over 2. So the general idea is that for every theta between 0 and 1, you can pick a q and an a of certain sizes, with a relatively prime to q, such that theta is well approximated by a over q in this particular sense. And we break up theta into two cases, the major arcs and the minor arcs, where you choose a threshold for how big q can be, and then you say anything less than that is small, and if theta is close to a rational approximation with small denominator, that's a major arc, and if it's close to something with a large denominator, that's a minor arc. And the really important things about the major arcs is that they're disjoint if you're looking at distinct pairs, a1, q1, and a2, q2. Now, we need a way to harvest this information we'll get out of the rational approximations, and we'll do that with Gauss sums. Each quadratic form has a Gauss sum associated to it. More traditionally, you'd see this as being e to the 2 pi I m squared a over q. That's what Gauss considered. But just as in Gauss's original case, there's a classical bound, which gives square root cancellation in each variable. So you get a bound of some constant that depends on the quadratic form and a q to the k over 2. Now, with the Gauss sum in hand and the transformation law for this theta function, you get an approximate identity. And this is, I guess, how a number theorist would think an approximate identity goes. This is not an approximation to the identity. But for y in a small dyadic region, you have that the theta function can be approximated by some arithmetic information, the Gauss sum, and some continuous information, the y to the minus k over 2. And then there's a remainder term. So we have to consider three types of contribution to the multiplier, the main term for theta in the major arcs, the main term for theta in the minor arcs, and the remainder term. And the general idea here is that the minor arcs are called minor for a reason. Their contribution is minor. At least you hope that it is. The remainder term you can deal with simply because it's small. And in the major arcs, you use the fact that they're disjoint. So each component that is supported on one unique or one distinct major arc is in the weak LR space as desired. And you're able to use the fact that the supports are disjoint to sum infinitely many of them and stay in the weak LR space. I don't want to go into more details here because I'd like to tackle something even harder, which is the J lambda operator for lambda less than a half. And in general, for lambda less than a half, things become much harder. So K lambda has a multiplier that looks exactly like that for I lambda, except that there's this twist of e to the 2 pi I m dot phi, where m is a k-tuple of integers, and phi is in the unit cube in RK, or the k-torus, I guess. Again, you can reduce consideration to a multiplier that's an integral from 0 to 1. And again, you have a theta function, which is the same as before, except with a twist. And you have a Gauss sum, also with a twist. And you have exactly the same kind of classical bound. So far, everything's basically the same. Once again, you have an approximate identity for the theta function. And you define your major arcs basically the same way. And again, you have this arithmetic information in the main term and then this continuous information, but now with this quite crucial exponential decay term here. Here I've used the notation that alpha is theta minus a over q, beta is phi minus b over q. So let's just consider the multiplier for the main term of this approximation with theta, phi, and the major arcs. And with some careful rearrangement, you can write it as an infinite sum of multipliers, where the index S refers to dyadic regions for the denominators Q, and we sum over the two types of numerators, A and B. We have the arithmetic information, then we have an integral of the continuous information. And here, this rho function basically tells you how good an approximation A over Q can be to a fixed theta. And that will become crucial in a moment. So, not surprisingly, we define a family of operators with those multipliers that I just defined. And it's sufficient for the purposes of the theorem we want to show to see that for lambda in the region we consider, and for conjugate exponents p and p prime, satisfying this condition required by homogeneity, that you have an LP LP prime bound with decay in S. And you need this decay in S so that you can sum from S equals 1 to infinity. Now we'll get this result via two interpolation estimates. First of all, on the line real part of lambda equals 1, we get an L2 L2 bound with nice decay in S. And this comes from directly bounding the integral in your multiplier, and also crucially from decay coming from the Gauss sum bound. On the line real part of lambda equals minus 2 over k, we'll get an L1 L infinity bound, and this comes from the Fourier coefficients of the multiplier, which is quite an interesting little phenomenon. We do have growth in S, but the key point is the growth isn't too bad, and interpolating between these two, each term will have some small non-trivial decay. Now, fortunately or unfortunately, depending how much you like complications, there's a significant difficulty in this method. So you can reduce it down to considering a multiplier that looks like this. So nothing fancy here. We're just looking at the integral. Remember, the integral goes down to this rho function, which doesn't matter so much what it is. It's important that it behaves like alpha squared. And alpha squared is localized by this characteristic function to be very close to the origin. Now, if we want to show that the Fourier coefficients of this are bounded where the real part of lambda equals negative 2 over k, because of the small support, we can actually take Fourier transforms, which is a bit easier. So let's take a Fourier transform with respect to the beta variable alone. It's interesting that you pass back to the original quadratic form when you take this Fourier transform. And quite nicely, you cancel out everything in the denominator. So things look great. But when you try to take the Fourier transform with respect to the first variable alpha, if you want to show that it's bounded, it would be enough to show that what you have here is integrable. But if you look on the line real part of lambda equals negative 2 over k, you see that you have something that's of size alpha to the minus 2. And that's not going to be integrable near the origin. Not even a chance. So you need to remedy this somehow. One idea is that you could try to replace this rho function, which is quadratic in alpha, by something that's linear in alpha. And then you'd hope that your integral looked like alpha to the minus 1 plus I gamma, with gamma non-zero, and then you'd get cancellation and you'd be okay. Another idea I had was to work not with the theta function, but with the double derivative of the theta function. Again, you get some kind of Jacobian inversion formula and you can carry out the argument. That actually seems to be even more work than this idea. And to accomplish this transformation from something quadratic to linear, what you have to do is do a double decomposition of the major arcs. So yet again, you break them into little dyadic pieces, you extract as much cancellation as you can from each one, and you're able to get the two interpolation estimates with decay on the one hand and small growth on the other. Everything works out after about 70 pages. So I won't say anything more about that, but I'd like to indicate why I find this problem so interesting and also why it's a bit hard. So going back to just these operators, as a number theorist, I'd be pretty happy to say something about quadratic forms. But as an analyst, I'd say, well, why not homogeneous k-forms? Why stop at the power 2? And in fact, on the continuous side, I can generalize results of Crisp to homogeneous k-forms without too much trouble. But there's really something very special about quadratic forms. If you look at the Jacobian version formula for the theta function, it's effectively the result of Poisson summation, and it hinges upon the fact that the Gaussian is its own Fourier transform. And you're really not going to get that kind of result for higher powers. But to point out that it's not just a problem of technique, and this, you know, maybe I need to look at something other than a theta function, let's go back even farther to this simplest of all operator. And suppose we replace this 2 here by a k, for k bigger than or equal to 2, then showing the optimal LP-LQ boundedness for this operator is equivalent to a very old and very hard conjecture in number theory called hypothesis k-star of Hardy and Littlewood. And hypothesis k-star is known for k equals 2. It's known trivial for k equals 2, actually. Known for k equals 3 under the generalized Riemann hypothesis, and totally unknown for k bigger than or equal to 4. So I'm able to actually obtain partial results for LPLQ boundedness for this by taking what's known about hypothesis k-star and working backwards. It would be wonderful to obtain new information about this operator and say something new about hypothesis K star. But that has yet to be done. Thank you. Yeah, so if you think about the number of representations of a positive integer by the sum of k k-th powers, and the hypothesis k star says that on average, that is of size, if you're looking at the number of representations of n, on average it's of size n to the epsilon. Yeah, basically. And it's known that, you know, individually, they are not n to the epsilon. And that's how you prove it when k equals 2. The number of representations by a quadratic form is n to the epsilon. But for higher powers, the best you can do is with Hoare's lemma. Well, I think that it probably makes more of an impact on the method of proof. So if you're looking at just fractional integration, you don't even need to do anything special for the discrete case. You can deduce it from the continuous case. And so in that instance, I haven't come across non-vanishing rotational curvature as being crucial for the, you know, actually applying the discrete methods. But that would be very interesting.
Any other questions?